From WAMU in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In the fall of 1991, Anita Hill spoke at the Senate confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. She said he sexually harassed her when she worked for him at the Department of Education and then at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. In her new memoir called Speaking Truth to Power, she says the event was a turning point in the awareness of sexual harassment and a wake-up call for women. She joins me in the studio to talk about her own experience and the issue of sexual harassment. You can join us throughout the hour on 800-433-8850. Here in the Washington area, 202-885-8850. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
You know, you say that this was not a book you really wanted to write or even intended to write. What did you have to do to overcome that reluctance?
Well, it was almost at one point as though I felt I had to write this book. So I had no choice but to really try to take control of what had happened and to really clarify my thinking about what had happened to me and what was happening to society. The process of writing it and the decision to write it actually meant that I simply had to face squarely all of the events, both the good side and the bad side of what was going on. And that was difficult.
Going on within you?
Within me and outside in the rest of society. Yes, society was changing because of what had happened in 1991 in October.
What would you say was the most difficult part for you?
Oh, clearly writing about the hearings themselves was the most difficult part. But I wanted to do it honestly. I didn't want to do it just from my own memory of the experience. So what I did was to really sit down and read the transcript of the hearing. And that was, in a lot of ways, like reliving it again. So I'd start reading, and then I would try to write about that portion of the hearing. And there were many days when I'd start to try to write about it. I was okay during the reading, but then I'd try to write about it, and I'd start crying because that's when the real pain would come out in my effort to really express what had happened.
Were you surprised at what you read?
I was really somewhat surprised because I knew how painful it was, but some part of me had convinced myself that it was – that maybe I had an exaggerated memory of how bad it really was. But then in reading what happened, I realized that I wasn't exaggerating at all.
In the book, you begin with Senator Hal Heflin's question to you midway through the morning of your testimony. You say that those questions revealed the truth about the hearing, that you were being treated as a defendant. When that realization came to you, did it cause you in any way to rethink your stance before the committee?
Well, in fact, it didn't, because I gave myself a charge before I went in to give my testimony. And my purpose in doing the testimony was to tell the committee what had happened, to do it as clearly and thoughtfully as I could, and to be as express about it and clear about it as I possibly could under the circumstances. That didn't change. I knew I could not change that. I didn't know what else I could possibly do other than what I'd already given myself the responsibility for doing. So even though their treatment might have differed, I knew that my role was still the same.
Of course, there was a switch right at the start. You had, what, been promised you would go first?
Well, and it made sense that I would go first, that I would say what I had to say, and then that there would be some kind of response to it from Clarence Thomas. But that got changed, got altered at the very last minute.
Were you informed?
I was informed, but it wasn't until very late the evening before.
I see.
And so I really had no idea when he went on what he might say. And that was part of the sort of the deviation from procedure, fair procedure that occurred, because I had no sense of what he was going to say. In addition, there was an effort to use my statement during his testimony so that my words would come out of the mouth of one of the senators instead of coming out of my own mouth, or they'd come out of the mouth of Clarence Thomas. And what I had been fighting for all along was the right to tell the story from my point of view instead of from the point of view of Clarence Thomas or the senators or even the reporters who had broken the story.
How do you think the situation might have been different had you gone first?
Well, I think if I had gone first, I think the process might have been more orderly and fair. The results may not have changed dramatically, but I think we would have adhered to a process and set a different tone for the opening of the hearing. And you may recall that when he went first, there was a request to use my statement during his opening testimony. And then there was this argument about the use of my statement during his opening testimony. And temper started to flare. People got riled and angry even before I sat foot in the hearing room. So there were already people who were really primed to attack me on this procedural point even before I sat down to open my mouth and give any kind of sworn testimony that day. So I walked into a really sort of the aftermath of an argument that hadn't been settled really to anybody's satisfaction. So it was very difficult. And I think the tone would have been different had I just been allowed to testify first. And that might have, the tempers may not have flared so early and so volatilely.
But do you think that, do you believe that there was a predisposition against your testimony from the moment you opened your mouth?
Well, even before came to Washington, there was a stated predisposition against my testimony. There were statements made by senators even before I had said anything to them. There, after the press conference in particular, there were statements made by the senators. Even President Bush himself said that this was part of a smear campaign. Even on the Democratic side, Senator DeConcini had said that, you know, I shouldn't have come forward or given the impression that I shouldn't have come forward, that, you know, women who are sexually harassed ought to take action. They ought to get angry and they ought to take immediate action. And so, and even he misrepresented what had happened at the time that I sent my statement forward, saying that I had sent it forward anonymously or called up anonymously. So there was this misinformation and expressions of predisposition.
Do you have any regret that you came forward?
You know, no, I don't regret that I came forward. Sometimes I think I wish I had done so earlier in the process. I think perhaps that's the only element that might have changed things. But then I'm not sure that it would have changed anything.
What do you think it might have changed?
Well, I think had I come forward earlier, there might have been more time to investigate the claim, if there was, in fact, going to be a fair investigation. There might have been more time to establish a procedure for hearing my statement. But on the other hand, the Republican senators were so determined to get this nomination through that there would have probably been more time for them to establish their campaign against me.
That's really one of the basic concerns in your book, isn't it? Your concern for the Supreme Court itself.
Well, I guess being a lawyer, I'm a great believer in process, and I understand how process can determine outcome. And I really believe that the selection of a person for the Supreme Court demanded a fair process so that whatever the issue that came up, when you're dealing with the Supreme Court, you should have a process for evaluating the information fairly and appropriately. When I came forward, people say, well, why didn't you file a claim earlier? This was not a personal claim. This was not about my settling any kind of dispute that I had with Clarence Thomas. This was about me providing information to the process for selecting someone to the highest court in the land, the court of last resort. And so this was not about a personal vendetta or even getting some kind of personal redress for my situation. That's not what I was looking for. I was looking to provide information to the process.
202-885-8850 or 800-433-8850. Anita Hill is with me. She, of course, lectures widely on the subject of civil rights and sexual harassment in the workplace. Her new book is called Speaking Truth to Power. I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. How do you, at this point, define sexual harassment, and how do you see the difference between illegal behavior and ill-mannered behavior?
Well, let me go back to one other point that I think that's important for us to make. In the context of that hearing of 1991, what we were doing at that point, or what we should have been doing, was evaluating Clarence Thomas's character and fitness for the court. The standard should have been whether or not I provided credible evidence that went to his character and fitness. Not necessarily even whether it met the legal standard for sexual harassment, but whether it went to his character and fitness and judgment and indicated that this was the kind of person that we should be looking to make decisions on the lives of the entire country, members of the entire country, citizens of this country. So how one defined the behavior for this context differs than how one might define it in a legal sense for a civil rights violation. I was not claiming a civil rights violation. What I was saying is that I have credible information and relevant information about how this person conducts his job, conducts himself in the workplace, and information that is relevant to how he may make decisions about other people's lives, particularly when it comes to civil rights issues. So I don't think the two are necessarily the same. And in fact, they shouldn't have been the same for this purpose. I think the senators really went off in the wrong direction when they looked at it only in terms of does what she have to say reach the level of an illegal behavior.
And perhaps one of the reasons the senators had such a hard time believing you was that you went from one position to another with Clarence Thomas.
And I think that is an issue of it has to be looked at in terms of credibility. And I talked about that at the time of the hearing. I attempted to explain it. I talk about it in the book. The real telling factor, I think, for me was the fact that the behavior had stopped. I think we all experience different kinds of behavior at work, some that we like and some that we prefer not to have. But once it stops, if you care about your job, if you care about what you're doing, very often you will stay in that job.
Yes.
And this behavior had stopped. And I cared about my job. I cared about the issues of civil rights. And I saw some opportunities to work in those in the area, not only in school desegregation and school civil rights issues, but also to take the information, what I had learned at the education department, and then expand on that in the employment arena.
Now, how much of a gap had there been in the behavior?
I think that, you know, there had been months. The behavior started fairly shortly after I went to education. And then it seemed to die down for weeks, after weeks of the behavior. And then maybe for a few months, there was nothing. There was a good, cordial working relationship. We didn't agree on all of the issues, but I believe that I was being treated with respect in terms of what I could offer the office and what I had to say about the issues. And so there was a gap of months, and it didn't happen. And then after I went to EEOC, it didn't begin again immediately. So there was some period of time when the behavior wasn't there. And I describe it in the book as there were either some other distractions or something that went on that kept him from relating to me in that way. But then, it picked up. And at that point, I did leave his employment. But I think you have to put this in the context of I loved the work that I was doing. I thought it was meaningful. And then also in a larger cultural context, I thought that I had controlled the situation, that I had handled it the way a professional would handle it, and that I was willing to continue doing my work and not cutting off myself from that opportunity.
Of course, isn't there another element here as exemplified by the fact that you had 12 members of your family show up at the hearing, and you introduced a number of them, the point being that your family, your background, everything you were was oriented toward not speaking out, toward not making those comments public.
That's right. And I think it comes from a whole generations, not just my immediate family, from generations of experiencing abuse or experiencing racism or threats and not speaking out, keeping it to yourself, working either to move on to a different place or to work out the situation in that particular place. And one of the things that I talk about in the book, that I try to express that in the book by talking about my family, my family history, and some of the adversity that my family has experienced, and really how we dealt with adversity. I come from this farm background, and from a background, my maternal grandparents had to leave their property in Arkansas to escape a racial threat that was aimed at my father because he refused to allow my grandmother to work for a man, a white neighbor. The white neighbor wanted my grandmother to
as
do his laundry.
Yes.
And my grandparents had 12 children, so they had small children at home, and my grandfather declined. But that was viewed as uppityness. Hmm. Now, the interesting thing about that story is that they did leave. They moved on to Oklahoma because my grandfather didn't want his children raised in that environment and believed that Oklahoma would be better for them. But I had not heard the story until I started doing research for this book. So even that was kept a secret. And my uncle said to me when I asked him about using the story, he said, well, you know, please don't use that story because they may use it to hurt you. So even at this point, there's this sense that if we tell about our painful experiences – that they will be used against us. And what I realize is there's this whole cultural way, or at least family way, of dealing with our pain.
And that really gets to the title of your book.
Right. I think I've broken the tradition. But wonderfully, I still have my family support. I've not remained silent. And even by writing this book, instead of just leaving Washington in October of 1991, going home and going about my business and saying nothing about how awful the experience was, I've broken the tradition actually once again. It's taken time. And I hope that in the time I've given a lot of thought to what the experience has meant, but and continue to mean. But at the same time, in my own way, I am being open and very expressive about what happened to me.
As a matter of principle, do you think that you had to
write this book? I had to, and I'm exercising a right that my grandparents couldn't exercise.
Anita Hill, and at 28 past the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You are no longer at the University of Oklahoma. Why not?
Well, immediately following the hearings, and I think sometimes people have a false impression. They think you leave that and you go home and everything is fine. Maybe there are a few other things that go on in your life, but your life is pretty much the same. I returned to the University of Oklahoma, wanted to continue my teaching, wanted nothing more than for my life to be back as it was, but that didn't happen. My first indication that I was not going to be viewed in the same way came almost a week after I got back to Oklahoma. There had been a promotional video done for the university, and I had been requested to appear in this video, and it was one that was going to be broadcast nationally during football game. This was during college football season. I had been asked to appear. I initially declined, and then I was sort of talked into it. So I appeared in the video, and it was supposed to run that week, the week after I returned. And the university pulled the video because of my presence. They didn't say they pulled the video because it wasn't good. They said quite clearly they thought that my appearing in the video would send the wrong message. My feeling was that the message it sent was that I was a part of this community and a valued part of the community. And by pulling it, it was that they didn't really want to acknowledge that I was a continuing part of the community. That was the first thing. But there were a series of responses to me that indicated that I was, in many ways, an embarrassment to the institution. And I talk about the whole series. They had a cumulative effect. There was a professorship that was established in my name, and it was fought like none other in the history of the institution. It became a political battle. And I think the whole issue or the debate with the professorship culminated when the provost, then acting provost, now the permanent provost at the university, asked me to change the name of the professorship to somebody else's name, even though we had collected money in my name and had told people that this is what the work will be for this professorship. It'll be to study issues of gender bias and racial bias in the workplace. And there was this effort and drive to get me to change the name of it.
I see.
That indicated to me that what the university wants is to kind of distance itself from you.
And what about former senator now, Oklahoma University President David Boren?
Well, he participated in it in a sort of oblique way. But on the one hand, he would say to people, she is a valued member of this community. On the other hand, when I was making the decision about coming back to the university after a leave, and I was trying to get some assurance that the professorship was going to be treated with respect, he refused to meet with me.
Interesting. You may know he was on this program before he went out to Oklahoma. And he said to me on that day that his vote for Clarence Thomas was one he regretted.
Well, he made that same statement in Oklahoma as well.
Yes.
But he also clarified the statement when he came to Oklahoma and said,
after it appeared on the front page of the Oklahoma
newspapers. He sort of backed down from that by saying it had nothing to do, his regret had nothing to do with me. But had more to do with what was developing as Clarence Thomas's record on the court. And I did not find that very comforting at all.
All right. We'll take a short break here. And when we come back, we'll open the phones for your questions, comments for Anita Hill on her brand new book. It's called Speaking Truth to Power, 202-885-8850 or 800-433-8850. I'm Diane Rehm. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Patricia D. Cornwell Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Diane Rehm, and here in the studio is Anita Hill. And, of course, during the 1991 confirmation hearings on the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, Anita Hill came forward and made public for the first time her experience of sexual harassment on the job in both the Department of Education and the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, working with Clarence Thomas. That became a huge scandal, if you will. Nevertheless, Clarence Thomas was, as you know, confirmed for his position on the Supreme Court and is a sitting justice. If you'd like to join us, I'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments between now and the top of the hour. Let's go first to Patricia, who's on a car phone here in Washington. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Morning.
Good morning. I first want to just tell Ms. Hill how proud I am of her. I think she's so brave and courageous.
Thank you.
And my heart really went out to her during the hearings. But my question, though, is I have a hard time thinking that the result would have been the same had the woman been white. And I just wondered what she thinks about that.
Well, I think the racial dynamics were there. I think when Clarence Thomas used his high-tech lynching, the lynching metaphor, he introduced the issue of race. But unfortunately, as the hearings got reported, it became a hearing about his race and my gender, as though my race was irrelevant. In fact, that is not the case. I'm not quite sure how it would have differed. The results would have differed. I don't think the Senate was ready to deal with the gender issues. But certainly, I think that the rigor of the attacks would have been different. And I think in particular, some of the very conservative senators who embraced Clarence Thomas would not have done so had I been white. And I just give one example of Strom Thurmond, a staunch Southerner and opponent of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. I'm not sure that he would have gone forward and embraced Clarence Thomas in the way that he did had I been white.
I agree. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Your or how some African Americans reacted to you must have been painful.
It was very painful, and there were people who express themselves as speaking for the African-American community. You know, I now realize that there are a number of voices in the African-American community, that there's not just one voice. But it was very painful at the time to almost be shunned by the community and told that even if what I said was true,
I shouldn't have said it at all,
that I was, in fact, harming the community by speaking the truth about my experiences. You know, I grew up and really came of age and was one of the few children in my family to go to an integrated school or start at an integrated school. I grew up and came of age during the Civil Rights Movement. And one of the lessons of the Civil Rights Movement for me was that the truth about our experiences is what liberates us, and that when we can tell the world what we experience, and even though it's painful and some people disagree with us and they dislike us, that that is what's important and that's what we should be doing. And then to be told in 1991 that I could only tell the truth about part of who I was and part of what I experienced. It was disenchanting and very painful, but it is also something that I had to face when I was writing this book, and I tell about how I got beyond that pain.
Hmm. I think there's another element here among those who perhaps continue to believe that you lied. And that is that if you didn't lie, then what you are saying is that there is a liar sitting on the Supreme Court.
Really, it does come down to that, the credibility issue. And there are certainly some things that people say, well, she's not credible because if this happened, she should have quit, or she would have quit, or she would never have gone to this other job. But even if you don't believe me, and if you think that there are problems with my credibility, I would ask the people take into account the fact that there were other women who were willing and ready to testify that they had experienced similar behavior. And when you take the cumulative effect of all of that evidence, I think one has to conclude that, in fact, unfortunately, there is a liar on the Supreme Court. My book is not about proving that, but my book is about explaining the totality of what happened and the ongoing impact of that. But I think that that is the case, and people aren't willing to deal with the reality of that. They'd much rather be convinced that, in fact, I lied.
Mm. In Berea, Ohio, Catherine, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. It's an honor to thank you for taking my call. I want to speak to Ms. Hill, who I consider someone who not only does not lie but does not exaggerate in the words of her friend who testified and completely convinced me at that moment that everything I was hearing was true. There are two things about the testimony, if you'll give me a chance, that I recorded. One was you said, I am not accusing him of sexual harassment, but of a pattern of behavior that's inappropriate for the court, which is what you've been saying this morning, too, and in your book, which is what you said. You were announced as someone who accused him of sexual harassment, and you did not. You said it's a pattern that you should know about. Then another part of the testimony is when Orrin Hatch said, if he has done anything or said anything like this, he is not only not fit to be on the Supreme Court, but not fit for any kind of public service or something to that effect. And it was set. You, after that, Arlen Specter had to do what he did, which was incredible, which was, you know, deny, somehow find some way of discrediting your testimony. And, of course, Clarence Thomas himself had denied uncategorically denied it all, to use his exact words. But I'd like your comment on it's actually not that you did not accuse him of sexual harassment, and that's an important problem.
All right.
That you run into.
Okay.
Well, that was the case because I knew that in that period of time that with the kinds of campaigns that was going on that we couldn't establish a legal claim, but I didn't believe that that should be the standard for this particular body. No, not only that, but I believe that this body couldn't really deal with that. And they didn't have the expertise, the experience to deal with that. But what Orrin Hatch did was really draw that line and said, if he did this, then he's unfit. Therefore, what we have to show is that this woman has absolutely no credibility at all. Because if anybody believes her, then that means, we've already said, he is unfit. So what they set the stakes, and consequently, they went out to destroy me. Because that was the only way they could justify their decision to continue to put him on the court, which they had already pretty much decided that they wanted to do. Interestingly, when you said that I don't exaggerate, one of my students described me to his father. His father called me and told me about this conversation. His father is a minister, and he said his son described me as the queen of understatement. and I didn't exaggerate. Yeah. And in the book, I don't really try to inflame the testimony or, you know, embroider it, or even the behavior of the senators. I really I'm taking care to report to you what they did and why it was wrong.
Do you think Democrats or Republicans were more at fault?
You know, both of them should have been more concerned about the process and creating a fair process. The chairman was responsible for doing that because it is his committee. And so the chairman, being Democrat, really had the responsibility for doing that and should not have let the procedure get completely out of control. So I blame the Democrats for that. The Republicans really went on the attack and abused the whole process by not focusing on what it was they were supposed to be doing, which was finding the best person for the position on the court, but focusing on the politics of the day and going after me as a political enemy.
You know, it was interesting in that sense because you even had people who became political spokespersons for Clarence Thomas.
It was really discouraging because not only did he have certain senators on the committee on his side, but he had the White House. He had, you know, people who had histories. Fitzpatrick had histories in the past of being political people, analysts, spin doctors, if you will, out there campaigning for him and speaking for him. I had a group of volunteers, some of whom had had some political experience, but none of them with the kind of experience or stature that his supporters had.
All right, here in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Hello, Neil. You're on the air. Neil, are you there?
I'm sorry.
Sorry, sir. Are you on a speakerphone?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Go ahead.
I didn't watch too much of the hearings, and I've never really been all that concerned about whether the allegations were true or not. I have a very basic question, which you touched on a little bit, but I think has gotten a lot less attention than the truth or falsity of the allegations, which is, let's assume that everything you said was true. He did what you said, and he lied about it afterwards. Does that invalidate him, in your opinion, from being confirmed as Supreme Court Justice?
Well, let me tell you why I think it's relevant. I think it goes to his judgment. I think it goes to his feeling of being a sense of himself as above the law.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last part.
His sense of himself as being above the law, okay. Even the law that he is there to enforce.
Right.
And when you take that into account, with the fact that he is going to be making decisions for the entire country, then an individual who thinks that he is above the law can find ways to put other people above the law, too. So I do think, yes, it does invalidate him, unless there is some way that you can see that there has been some change or some regret for this behavior and a disavowal of this kind of behavior. And I don't think that was coming. It was a complete denial of the behavior. So, again, I think the complete denial itself makes the point that I can be above the law, I can act in this way, and then continue, and I should go unpunished, or there should be no adverse results to this behavior. I should never be accountable.
Okay, well, I would just make the observation that, leaving aside for the moment whether or not I think Clarence Thomas just per se was a good choice for Supreme Court justice, there have been a lot of leaders in this country and in other countries over the centuries who have had less than perfect personal lives and have done things that people would not agree, who ultimately made very good leaders. And I'm not saying that he makes a very good justice or makes a very bad justice, but I would suggest that, in my personal opinion, a lot more attention was paid to that than to the kinds of issues that I want my justices to be chosen for, which is their stance and their views on how they're going to judge laws. But thank you for taking my call.
But let me make one follow-up comment.
Okay. Yes,
I think, unfortunately, we are seeing the court as a political body. I think when you talk about a lot of good leaders, you may be referring to political leaders. We're talking about a lifetime appointment on the court of last resort. And that's a very different position than an elected position to even the Department of State, or an appointed position to the Department of State, or even the Justice Department. We're talking about a lifetime appointment to a court that is charged with being fair and impartial. So I think let's not blur the lines here and think that the person that who might make a good president will necessarily make a good Supreme Court justice. The charge is higher.
Okay.
All right, Neil. Thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. And Anita Hill is with me. Her new book is called Speaking Truth to Power, and of course talks about the 1991 hearings on the confirmation of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court and the aftermath. And at 10 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Caller in Dallas, Texas. Patricia, you're on the air.
Hello.
Morning.
Good morning. So nice to talk to you. I'm Miss Hill. You were my contracts professor in University of Oklahoma in 87. You might remember me because, like, in November of 87, I had a cerebral hemorrhage and it stopped.
Oh, yes, I do. How are you doing?
Oh, just great. Just great.
Good. Good.
Yes. But what I had to say is I respect you immensely. You're very intelligent. You're very caring. As far as I'm concerned, there's not a part of you that would ever lie about anything. And what went on was what you told about are things that I experienced in the workplace. You know, I mean, I worked for 20 years before I went to law school,
right.
And I was used to coming with all this with guys in the 60s and the 70s. But people have asked me about you and what I thought about what you had to say, and I have said, it happened. It happened, or she wouldn't have told it.
Mm-hmm.
It happened, or she would not have, going through that hearing and having all of those men listen to what you had to say, and they just went, ta-ta. What's so wrong here? Probably half of them had the same thing, did the same thing that said Thomas did. But at any rate.
Well, thank you for calling. I'm glad to know that you're doing well now. And I think that there was a lot of dismissal and denial, willful denial, and really the sort of sense of, well, so what, you know, maybe because in some ways they thought it was so prevalent that it didn't matter.
Hmm.
But I think, unfortunately, they miscalculated really the impact of this. And the image of seeing this behavior really resonated with so many women.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that because it seemed to me that polls taken at the time of the hearings were very different in their results from polls taken later. And certainly as the issue of sexual harassment came more and more to the fore, it would seem public opinion changed rather dramatically.
And it's great significance. We've had the law governing sexual harassment on the books since the late 70s. But it wasn't until 1991 that people really became aware of it and it became part of a vocabulary. There was this real gap between the law and the people who the law was there to help for years and years. And it was as though somehow they pushed a button and it opened up the experiences. Not only were people filing more complaints, but they were also talking about it and being much more open about it than they had ever been in the past. It was really liberating for a lot of women. Contrary to what the pundits assumed would happen, women came out and talked more and didn't hide because of the Senate's behavior.
Anita, what do you say to those people, and there are many, who continue to believe it was you who lied? What do you say to them?
Well, you know, I don't address them directly. I say read the book and really try to understand the dynamics of what was going on. Because even if you think that I didn't tell the truth, the process was still abused. And even if you think I didn't tell the truth, you cannot deny the experience of hundreds of women who are in the workplace now or have been in the workplace in the past. And unfortunately, you're by the same token, denying the experience of this next generation of girls that are going to come out. You know, recently there have been polls that women, even though 1990 what happened and we're now more open to the issue, there have been recent polls that are saying that women are still being sexually harassed. I get calls from women who say they can't find legal representation. So, yes, I realize that there is still a lot of denial. I don't mind so much if you deny my claim, but let's not deny the existence in society because we're all going to suffer if that happens.
And let's go to Eric in Fairfax, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Anita Hill, how you doing?
Well, thank you.
I believed every word you said concerning Clarence Thomas and the things he did do. Just like Thurgood Marshall stated that a snake will bite you whether you're black or white. And Clarence Thomas, you know, I felt like he was lying coming from that aspect. But another thing I want to bring up, do you think the reason why the senators backed him so viciously and was the fact that they may could use him, have him on the bench for most of their conservative agendas that are being passed thus far, and with the conclusions coming out from the court where you know you got a one person that'll give you their vote? I'll listen to it off the air.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
Well, in terms of the very conservative senators, I do think that clearly his backing came from what they thought they were going to get. And the way race was manipulated in that was that they thought that they would get that conservative vote, but that he would be subject or he would not be attacked because of that, because he was a black man with a conservative attitude, if not agenda. So I think that there was clearly politics going on, and there was a manipulation almost of the quote-unquote liberal senators by using his race to keep them quiet. And there was a support by the conservatives because they knew what they would get for him.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being here. And lest there is any confusion, there wasn't one caller who came through this morning on this screen throughout the whole hour who was speaking out in opposition. Very interesting.
Well, it is very interesting, and I just hope that the callers who are supporting can carry this issue and understand the significance of what happened.
And the book is called Speaking Truth to Power, the author, Anita Hill. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carol Beach, Sally Baker, Sandra Pinkerton, Dorothy Buckhagen produce the program. Eric Teets has been on the phones for us. Karen McManus and James White are the engineers. The program comes to you from WAMU at American University. If you'd like a cassette copy of this or any of our programs, please call 202-885-1200. I'm Diane Rehm. This is NPR, National Public Radio.